This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Inside the Banjoverse, exploring the minds of folk music's great artists. If you love the stories behind bluegrass, Irish folk, and Americana, then this podcast is for you. This is Enda Scahill from Irish bluegrass crossover band Wee Banjo 3. Before you freak out, don't worry, there's actually four of us, and mostly just one banjo. That's me. Ross Holmes is an American violinist originally from Fort Worth, Texas, now resident in Nashville. A great friend of Wee Banjo 3, Ross has worked with some huge bands such as Mumford & Sons, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers, and quite famously as founding member of progressive bluegrass group Cadillac Sky. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Ross Holmes. That's so good.
It's a lot when you're not warmed up.
Oh, man. Well, it's 11 o'clock in the morning in Nashville, Tennessee, and it is 5 o'clock in the afternoon here in Galway. It's great to see you, Ross.
You too, and I'm jealous. It's breakfast time here and pub time there, so you've got the advantage.
Pubs are closed, man.
I know, but the spirit, you can still pour yourself a pint and it's acceptable. I have to endure the coffee right now.
So that's great. So you're living in Nashville. You're originally from Texas. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Ross.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas, which is North Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. For those who follow Irish music, the North Texas Irish Fest is one of the larger ones in the States. I grew up going to that festival, watching bands play and hoping someday to perform. And so that's the northern part of Texas. And then I moved to Nashville about a decade ago, although I had been working up here for many, many years prior to that. finally, the move was justified because I was spending so much time in recording session land up here, and a couple of the bands that I was involved with were based here or loosely based here. And it's also Music City, America. I mean, it's the place to be if you're trying to do what we do. There are wonderful music cities, Chicago, Austin, New York, LA, but there's no city that really truly encompasses the spirit of the music industry, as well as the range of artists, not just country artists as people think of Nashville, but Americana, folk, jazz, classical music. They all kind of find their way here eventually. And so Nashville, I don't know, you've spent some time here. You know the vibe. Yes. It's a special place.
It is. It's a pretty understated city in comparison to Chicago or New York or Austin, as you mentioned. But the music is fabulous. It's incredible. Incredible. And we've made some great friends there over the years, including yourself. But I'm gonna say the first time that I met you, if I'm correct in saying this, was actually backstage after Mumford & Sons gig in Galway quite a while ago. So you toured with Mumford & Sons for a while. You were friendly with Martin Howley from Wee Banjo 3.
Yeah.
You had met Martin in Nashville at the Opry when Martin was playing with a band that I used to play with. So it's all quite complicated.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, sorry. I'm trying to piece it together. So it was Brock McGuire band, but was it Gary Amaro that was playing banjo then?
No, it was Martin.
It was Martin, but when did Gary come out? Because I met him another time too. And then, all these banjo players.
Yeah. So the band would have come back through and with Gary had replaced Martin in the band. Martin filled in for me when my son, my wife was pregnant on, on that one tour. We had just come from Texas, actually.
That's right. Great. So would have that been 2011 maybe?
That would have been 2009.
2009. Oh yeah. My gosh. Wow. It's the years of all this are just, it's incredible to try to piece together. But yeah, so I guess it would have been the stopover festival that we did in Galway at the Salt Hill, Salt Air.
It was in Salt Hill. Yeah. Yeah.
That
was
Salt Hill. Yeah.
Gentlemen of the Road Fest. Yeah. What was that like?
Yeah. Man. So I was with Mumford & Sons 2010 through 14, and it was an amazing experience. I came into the band. I was in a bluegrass band for a long time called Cadillac Sky, which is a very progressive, well, started out as a more, I don't want to say traditional bluegrass band, but leaning towards the traditional side. What started out as that sound with Cadillac Sky eventually became basically a rock and roll band with bluegrass instruments.
When that fire burned down to ashes, Danny stared out the window pane. Mama knew without asking, her traveling man had no plans to stay.
But at some point in our journey, when Mumford & Sons was just getting going and they were discovering Americana music, Cadillac Sky and Old Crow Medicine Show were the two bands that had somewhat of a presence in England, and they were turned on to those two projects. And we met and toured with them, and then as soon as Cadillac Sky ended, I made my little shift over to Mumford & Sons, and it was right as their first record, Sign No More, was taking off. I think they had two singles at the time. They had Little Lion Man and The Cave had just come out, or it was the other way around. It gets lost in my head, but they were starting their sort of meteoric rise when I slipped into the fold, and then was with them as they blasted to the top of their genre, the top of the field. And man, it was incredible to go from my band playing, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 seat venues, and that was about the same size as Mumford & Sons was playing, to headlining Glastonbury Festival for 200,000 people, all within the span of a few years. It's really an amazing thing to be a part of. It's an amazing thing to witness. What doesn't happen, though, is it doesn't make you a better player. It doesn't make you a better human. It just amplifies everything. You're just tweaked out all the time because of the lights and the energy and the scope of everything. It's just amplified. And when I left Mumford in 2014 and began my time with Bruce Hornsby, I went from the rush of playing these big festivals and arenas to getting back to the nature of what it is that I loved so much, which was just playing and truly playing, truly improvising and living in a wholly musical environment versus a wholly lights and flash and pyrotechnics environment. Mm. And it's not diminishing the music of Mumford, because it's powerful stuff. Those guys are family, literally. And I'm so grateful for the time. But for those of us that are players and really have invested our focus and energy into our craft, you know, moments like that are a treat to play big gigs. But I'd much rather invest my time into an audience that wants to listen, an audience that's there to focus on this craft that I've poured so much of my time into.
That's really interesting, because a lot of people would assume that if you had a gig like Mumford & Sons, you would just sit back, you know, watch the paycheck roll in every week and kind of enjoy the buzz of playing with such a huge band. But there's more music that you're seeking. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's an interesting experience to be around people that are very successful in music, because all the trappings come with it. You have zero anonymity anymore. Everywhere you go, you're recognized by people, and anything you could ever want, whether it's an instrument or recording equipment or a big home or a fancy car, all that stuff just kind of happens as a result of that success. And over time, I think what happens to a lot of people is that they become very accustomed to that. And I'm not saying this about Mumford, because those guys work incredibly hard to this day. But there are many people that we've all met that you go, oh, you're just cruising. There's no that youthful desire to really march forward in your career and take huge strides with your progress and your growth as a player, as a singer, as a composer, a lyricist. Those things kind of settle back when all those luxurious things start creeping in. At least that's been my observation of it. And I never want to settle at any level of ability. I want to continue to grow as a player and search for new sounds and new outlets for what the fiddle with the violin can do, how it can contribute. I love that quote. There's the famous cellist Pablo Casals, who in his 90s was asked why he still practiced hours a day, and he said, "I feel like I'm getting better." Yeah. And it's an amazingly personal and heartfelt statement that I really get that so much. And so for me, that was an amazing chapter. But I was missing, you know, when in that band, there's no with Mumford, there was no improvising. You know, with We Banjo 3, you guys get up and there are spots where everyone solos, and in the process of soloing, you're playing something that you didn't play the night before. It's a new idea, largely based on the energy of the band and the energy of the audience. But in Mumford, the songs were very arranged and they were set in place, and so there was no room for soloing or improvising. And I was really, really missing that from a performance standpoint. Now, the rest of my time outside of that band during those years, I was really involved in the recording session scene here in Nashville, playing on big projects with artists. But even then, it's not playing playing solos under a microphone in a recording studio, a little isolation booth, is vastly different than improvising a solo that you can't take back in front of an audience. You know, we can punch in a solo even here with Skype. If something happens, a technological glitch, we can cut it, crop it, edit it, and make it look seamless. In live setting, you have to trust your hands. You have to trust your ears. You have to trust your heart. And that rush, that is, to me, is the essence of being a musician. And it doesn't matter if you're doing it in front of a million people or your grandma. That still should be felt if you're really connecting with the heart and soul of what it is that you're trying to say through your instrument. And it's powerful.
Does it always work? I mean, I know from my point of view, there's nights, most nights you come off stage and you're, you know, and it depends on such a number of factors like energy and the audience and everything. What do you do with those nights where you've just had a car crash and everything you've played is awful? Or do you even have those kind of nights?
I certainly do. And it's scalable. You know, and what I mean by scalable is that I think that as you progress as a musician, you recognize your level of ability and what you're able to accomplish in performance through your instrument or singing. And the nights that you don't nail it, I guess I grew up playing baseball. I love it so much. And I know it's not really a deal in Ireland, but everybody knows baseball. Everybody knows the New York Yankees and the LA Dodgers. There's an old saying that my coach told me, because I would spend hours, you know, practicing my swing and trying to connect bat and ball every time I got to the plate. But as he said, nobody can bat 1,000, meaning nobody can hit the ball every single time they get up to the plate. You might strike out. You might hit a pop fly. You're going to get out sometimes. You're not always going to land on a base. And it's the same thing with shows. You can't bat 1,000. You can't expect that every gig that you play is going to be perfect. I would venture a guess, and I don't know this as fact, but I would venture a guess that most artists in any field, whether it's music or painting or poetry, at some point when you're working on something, whether it's a performance or a painting or a poem, you recognize, look, I'm making a contribution. It's positive. It's a step forward. It's not my best work. I've got to go on to the next thing. I've got to get on to the next gig tomorrow night. I've got to get on to the next painting that I'll start next week. I've got to get on to the next poem because better words will come. And so you accept it for what it is, and hopefully you have enough personal insight to reflect back and see where you can improve, and then take that information, that knowledge, and then build upon it for the next show. And for me, at least, I found that as I've progressed through life in this career, my tendencies for having okay shows, though that might have been a 40 to 60% ratio, are now probably at a, for every 10 gigs I play, I'm going to have 7 or 8 great gigs and a couple, 2 or 3 that are so-so. Maybe it's audience energy. Maybe it's sound issues. Maybe it's just, I'm not in sync with my hands, whatever it is, but I accept it. And I certainly don't dwell on it, because that just causes me to be depressed, and I would rather not exist. So
how do you cope then with, we'll say, in-ear monitors or on-stage monitors, loud? Bruce Hornsby famously is loud.
Yeah.
Does that affect you? I know that it affects me enormously. My favorite setup is a really nice microphone, a really nice monitor, and relatively quiet concert, and preferably sitting down, and then I can hear and feel everything perfectly. But there's a compromise to be made. So we play with in-ear monitors, which is largely like listening to your banjo through a phone that somebody has rang you from Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Huge compromise to be made. Sometimes it's a real struggle. Is that easier with the fiddle? I mean, you haven't played my banjo, so I can't compare exactly, but...
But I know it's a fantastic banjo. There's a very interesting disconnect. My favorite setup is performing into a microphone with a small monitor and fairly quiet stage volume, because more than anything, I want to hear the actual sound of my violin. There's a deal that happens with fiddle where when I'm playing, the instrument is physically connected to my head, and particularly my left ear. I feel the vibrations of the strings in the box going through my jaw. And when things are out of tune, it's like my inner ear moves differently than when I'm playing in tune and I can hear properly. Everything is like moves seamlessly. When things are off, I feel this weird jolting vibration that happens. And it's frustrating. It's using in-ear monitors closes off that natural sound of the instrument, and it's this weird irony, because really nice in-ear monitors allow you to hear clearly, and they do a good job of representing the tone of your instrument, although the instrument's plugged in. That's another thing to contend with versus the natural tone. It's weird to have this clear sound coming in my ear, but it literally, my instrument being inches away from what I'm hearing, going through all this technology, packs and receivers and transmitters, and it's... So for me, I made the decision a couple of years ago when I started playing with the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band that I would stop using in-ear monitors. And it really helped my comfort level again with my violin and finding that a better play. That's one of the reasons why the consistency of better shows has increased for me, is that I am back to playing on a wedge. The danger, though, is playing with a six-piece band with electric bass and drums and keyboard and amps everywhere. It's a fucking nightmare. is that it does get really loud on stage, and you have to contend with the risk and danger of being pummeled by all that loud stage volume. So I don't always, because sometimes I forget, but I have, instead of in-ear monitors, I use the in-ear molds that are just for sound killing. So it knocks down the stage volume. I think the pair that I have knocks it down 15 decibels. So I'll put one in my right ear, leave my left ear open. I still hear the stage. It kills a bit of that top end blast. And it seems to work well for me, but there's no substitute for sitting or even standing, but playing on a microphone with a wedge and really hearing the acoustics of a space and hearing the nature of your instrument. You just connect so much more with that. It's but it's impossible to do that when you're playing big festivals like you guys are doing. You know, Kansas City, you're playing for tens and tens of thousands of people, and you can't just play on a microphone.
No.
You have to plug in.
And when you move around, what used to happen to me, particularly when we had monitors, is that I'd be standing in front of my monitor, which was banjo heavy, and I was in banjo heaven. And if I moved over to the other side of the stage, then there was like, lads, you have no banjo at all. I was like, I've entered the dead zone. I'm just silent. I got to go back over to my own side now.
So when you're performing, are you wired in or are you wireless?
We're wireless. Yeah, so we're wireless instruments, wireless ears. We can run around all over the place, yeah.
Hey, Pantheon listeners. Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Yeah, it makes it really convenient. And of course, you know, the technology now with wireless packs, you can have a very small rig and complete accuracy. There's no like latency or impedance of tone. You know, it's really fantastic. But that's the problem when you're playing on wedges with wireless and you journey over to your bandmates to, you know, tell a joke or interact for a part of a song, and you go, wait, you don't have any fiddle in your wedge, you selfish bastard.
Oh yeah, listen, take us right back to the early days. What attracted you to the fiddle, and what music did you start playing?
So, growing up in Texas,
I'm gonna segue from this into your album, because I have a feeling that the title of it is linked. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Take us on that journey.
My mom's dad, my granddad, was a doctor in Fort Worth, where I grew up, and lived with us once he retired. He moved in with us, and his, besides practicing medicine, his real love in life was the fiddle. And it goes back generations in our family. I think it was my either two great grandfathers or three great, great, great grandfather. That side of the family lived in Nebraska, in the heartland of America. They were from Ireland. They were from County Clare, and they moved over in the mid 1800s and grew corn, and they grew wheat, and soybeans, and they grew hemp plants, although they didn't realize the smoking potential of it. They grew hemp, and they, you know, they, all this stuff was for mass agriculture, for feedlots, and for the U.S. military, just surplus big stuff. And at some point in time, with one of those grandfathers that was back there, their farm in Nebraska was a the Oregon Trail, the famous trail that went to the West Coast, crossed their property. And at some point, somebody traded one of my ancestors some work or some food for a fiddle. And the fiddle has remained in our family for generations. And it's this, it's one of those stories that you read about and you go, oh, that's totally fiction. No, my sister has the fiddle, and the old newspaper clippings from like the 19-teens and 1920s, when little local newspapers would write about this fiddle that my grandfather and my great grandfather would play at dances out for the farmers. Anyway, World War II happened. He moved to Texas, became a prominent figure in town with his medical practice, and that was his focus. And but when he wasn't doing medicine, he was playing the fiddle, and that was his. He loved it. And of course, growing up around that, you know, he would leave his fiddle out and sit down and play piano, or grab his fiddle and play tunes on the porch. And my sister, who's 3 years younger than I am, when she was five, she told my mom that she wanted to play that violin that you could clap your hands and stomp your feet to. And immediately my granddad was like, I know what to do with this one. And so he got her a little fiddle, and she started taking lessons. And it was a year later, she was six, I would have been nine at the time. I had just been watching her learn the fundamentals of how to hold the instrument, how to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And of course, I had been watching my grandfather. And I walked into her, this memory is still so clear today as it was when it happened. I walked into her room, her fiddle was sitting on her little twin size bed in its case, the case was open. I got the fiddle out and I just started to play. I started to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. I started to play some scales that I had heard, and I started to play the old fiddle tune, Boil the Cabbage. And I remember looking up as my mom and grandfather entered the room, and they said, Katie, you've never sounded wow. Ross. And we borrowed a friend's small fiddle, and I started lessons a week later. And that was that. And so we didn't go the route of classical violin studies, which is most common for kids living in a city. You know, you start with the Suzuki violin method or one of those variants. We went straight into fiddling, proper Texas contest style fiddling, which would be the equivalent, the Texas equivalent of the traditional Irish music that you'd have for the All Ireland championships, you know?
Yeah.
So our Texas equivalent of that, and that tune that I played at the top is the most common Texas style breakdown, Sally Gooden. And so that was really where Katie and I both began with fiddling in that specific genre, and then quickly branched off our interests in jazz and Western swing and Cajun music and Celtic music, all kind of happened at that exact same time, because my parents and my grandfather, they loved all of the genres of music and would play it throughout the house all the time. So it was just natural to pick up the fiddle and play along with the Chieftains live at the Belfast Opera House featuring Roger Waters and Nancy Griffith. You know, that the albums like that, they were just part of our growing up. And so our interests, mine in particular, my interests in all the different genres those ideas infused themselves into my playing at a very mm-hmm. early age. And then it was when I was a teenager that I started not studying classical violin, but taking lessons from a classical violinist, mostly for technique and posture, building dexterity around the fingerboard, understanding music theory, ideas of composition. And that has led to this whole journey. I realized probably earlier than I even remember, but I remember being about 15, 16 years old going, I think this is what I have to do with my life. I probably had come to that conclusion before then, but just didn't recognize that. And here we are. And so, yeah,
That leads neatly onto your solo album, which was that last year that you brought that out?
That came out in 2018, yeah. October 23rd of 2018.
Well, time has lost all meaning in the last couple of months, Ross.
Yeah, it has lost all meaning. The date was important for me to put it out, October 23rd, because that was my grandfather's birthday, and he would have been 98 that year. But I needed to put it out on his birthday because he was the force behind why I do what I do. For good or bad, for the triumphs in my life and the moments of just absolute pain and suffering, I can thank him for that because of the fiddle. So the album is called Not Very Good at Winning, because as a kid growing up playing in fiddle contests, those were my opportunities to perform. It was nice to win some money and take home a trophy, but for me, it was getting on stage and playing with some accompanists where I could perform these ideas that I had been shedding, you know, for the weeks leading up to the contest. And more than anything, it just gave me an opportunity to improvise in front of people. And so absolutely, there were times when I might have been the best fiddle player by a country mile playing in the contest, but I totally abandoned the rules and abandoned, you know, the sensible thing to try to win. And I might get fourth or fifth place, you know, win $15 and slap on the back from one of the judges, you know, try harder next time. And I'm going, I just kicked everybody's ass. What are you talking about? But it didn't conform to the rules of the fiddle contest. Yeah, yeah. And that became sort of my MO as I went through contests and did that whole thing. But a few years back when I started, when I had enough time to really invest into a lot of these solo projects that I've had shelved for years because of my investment into other bands and other artists, when I finally said it's time for me to start pursuing these, I've evaluated where I needed to begin, and I kept coming back to the notion of putting out that an album of Texas fiddle contest style tunes, because it's the genesis of my playing. It's the origin story of where I'm at now, why I do what I do, all comes from those lessons, those tunes. It's the foundation of it. And though it's not the world that I live in now as a player, it's still very comfortable for me to, it's like your mom's chicken noodle soup, you know, just nobody's chicken noodle soup is better than mom's. And that's just the thing with these fiddle tunes is I don't live in them. I don't play in contests. I don't do that world anymore. But when I just sit down and I start playing, inevitably I play an old Texas contest style fiddle tune. It's just it's my warm blanket. It's my chicken noodle soup.
That's wonderful.
And I love it. Yeah.
So you have a new project launching in June. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yes. So after I released Not Very Good at Winning, the contest album, I shifted all my focus into two separate projects. One is a big lyrical album, which has now been stalled because who can go in the recording studio and record? But the other project that has commanded most of my focus is a large work for solo fiddle and orchestra called the American Fiddle Suite. It's a 13-movement work that originally started, and this is kind of cool, for several years now, I'd say about 3 years, on social media, particularly Instagram, I have shared, by and large, though I'll play the occasional fiddle cover tune, 95% of the material that I post in terms of videos are melodies that I've written. And a lot of these melodies, I won't say which ones, but a lot of these melodies and themes have become a part of or were taken from this larger work of the American Fiddle Suite. And I've kind of dropped them out there as little Easter eggs along the way. And as I'm working with a collaborator in Washington, D.C., Aaron Malone, who's this brilliant fiddle player, a brilliant composer. And in the early stages in 2018 of us working on this American Fiddle Suite, I started taking some of these themes and compiling them into medleys, mostly for the sake of just remembering the melodies. I found it easy to do inside of a melody because a transition might trigger a thought about going to this particular idea, whatever it was. And what started out as a couple little themes became a 15-minute through-composed work that's not written. This particular piece is not written, but it became what I've called the overture, the solo violin overture to the American Fiddle Suite. And living through this time that we're in right now with coronavirus, COVID-19, and isolation, and really at this point watching this nasty, vitriolic nature of political partisanship, and just the world just feels like it's being yanked apart in many ways. It kind of hit me a little while back, about a month ago in this process. I woke up one day thinking about the true spirit of this piece is inclusivity and bringing together genres of music, styles of music, and the larger idea of that being bringing together people. And though this is this piece that I'm releasing in June, the overture to the American Fiddle Suite, is for a solo instrument, it's the spirit of it is what matters the most to me personally. And that is, as I said a second ago, inclusivity, embracing the beauty of all of our cultures, all of our outlooks on life, whether we agree with them or not, they exist. And we have to recognize that, you know, we're human beings and our experiences in life are singular to each one of us. So I'm really excited about this piece coming out in June. It's more than anything, I kind of shocked myself. I had a recording session at a very well-known studio. I think you guys have been there, Ocean Way Studio here in Nashville. It's this beautiful old church that was converted many years ago into a major recording studio here in town. And I had a session in the morning, and then there was a big session one afternoon. This was, I recorded this June 10th of 2018. And I asked the engineer, I said, look, I have this piece. You've got some mics set up. He said, we got 30 minutes if you want to try to record this thing. How long is it? I said, it's 15 minutes. He said, well, you're going to have one chance to get this right. And I was just thinking I would do a pass and then have it for reference as far as practice and revisiting it so I could refine the ideas. I didn't expect to sit down and 15 minutes later have the exact recording that I'm putting out in June. There's no overdub. There's no punch in. It's all just one pass. And I don't know how or why I managed to catch lightning in a bottle that day, but I did. And I'm incredibly proud of the recording and my performance of it, of this piece. But again, beyond that, I'm excited about sharing a work that focuses on just the spirit of people and bringing people together. So
awesome. So where can people find that? It's coming out in June. How do they follow?
Yeah. So you can follow me on social media, Ross Holmes Fiddle on Instagram, Real Ross Holmes on Twitter. Although I don't really tweet much. I hate it. Facebook, I'm pretty shit at, but you can find me there too. Ross Holmes Fiddle, I think. But it will be on all the streaming services. There's no point right now in pressing copies of any of this because who's going out to buy at shows? And really, I think it's responsible of everybody to save their bucks, because who knows when we'll be working again. Yeah. That actually, sorry, not to tangent, but I was in this discussion the other day, and I'd love to get your thought on this because it's really important. You, with We Badger 3, you guys are incredibly known in that scene and are one of the biggest, most happening bands on the planet to represent Ireland. I know that you guys do struggle, as all of us do, with the conflict of streaming services, where you don't make hardly any money off of royalties, versus sales at shows where people buy your merch, they buy your album, they buy your t-shirts, your swag. Do you think that as we're going through this process, and you know, more than ever, people are turning to streaming services just for an escape, listening to the music, we have to have an outlet for that. Do you think that it's important as artists that we maybe consider limiting what music is available on streaming and directing people to actual hard copy sales or buying digital copies as a way for us to earn a living, or is it more important to be available and out there for people to discover, to bring a bit of light? It's an interesting thought, both sides. What do you think?
Yeah, if we feel that streaming services are kind of a necessary evil, in that it's kind of that old chestnut of exposure. But I mean, our experience with We Banjo 3 fans is that they've been incredibly supportive, especially in this lockdown, and have bought tons of t-shirts and hard copy CDs and vinyl and all sorts of stuff from our website. And it's been fantastic. And we've never had an issue selling stuff at gigs. I mean, fans are just so generous. They just buy and buy and buy. The streaming services, funnily enough, in the Irish context, it's not a huge market. So a lot of the very traditional Irish bands, a lot of them aren't on Spotify or similar services. And if they are, the play numbers are low. Like they're nothing compared to even a bluegrass or Americana by play numbers. So it's an interesting market in itself, even just to look at it from that point of view. Now, the algorithm constantly places us with other Irish bands that don't have huge stream numbers.
Yeah,
we've been, and this is kind of the benefit of the Spotify model, is that some of our songs have been included on big folk playlists. Those playlists have driven our streaming numbers into the millions, where naturally by the algorithm, they probably wouldn't have got anywhere near that. As you said, it still doesn't pay an enormous amount of money, and it's always going to be way better if someone goes and downloads your album from iTunes or physically buys a CD. I mean, I don't even have a CD player.
Yeah, my computer doesn't. My Sarah's car doesn't. Yeah. I mean, it's...
But without a doubt, I have... And in the lockdown, I have bought many albums on iTunes, and I bought tracks on iTunes. If there's something that I love, I'll buy it. And it's only 99 cents. I mean, I often paid $5 for a terrible cup of coffee at Starbucks.
Exactly. Yeah, we're very quick to stop in and get a cup of coffee that's gone versus 99 cents where we go, but I could stream it for free.
Yeah.
And it's this weird conflict. And I find it amazing that the last several years, vinyl has outsold CDs by many factors. And it's an incredible thing that this old technology, vinyl, has been around for decades. It's making this resurgence. Funny enough, at the same time, I keep reading about how all these folks are starting to renovate and invest in these drive-in movie theaters, because who wants to go sit in a movie theater now with all these folks?
That's right.
You know, with COVID-19. So the idea of going back to this old technology is pretty interesting. It keeps people engaged. It keeps people moving and feeling human, all while doing so safely. And you can put on a vinyl record. The experience of putting a vinyl onto a player and setting the needle and listening through good speakers is fulfilling. It's not the same thing as going to a live gig, but it's maybe the next closest thing.
There's a ritual to it. It's a bit like making your own coffee at home. If you grind your beans and do the whole AeroPress thing, there's a ritual that's much better than just go in and get a takeaway cup and it's drank and it's gone, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Hopefully we'll see the trend of that affect us all positively and be able to, as musicians, benefit in whatever way or ways come from that positively, you know?
It's just
an interesting time.
Have you warmed up enough for a final tune, Ross? Will you play us out?
Yeah, actually, you know, I'm going to play a tune that your bandmate, Fergal Scahill, taught me. It's one of my favorite Irish tunes, and I don't pretend to be an Irish player at all, but I love it so much. It's the Flooded Roads of Glenties. And I heard it off of, Wayfarer, I think, was the record that it was on.
Mm.
And it just killed me when I heard it. I was just, oh, dude, you're just so salty. Ah, and so he showed it to me at a festival a long time ago. And man, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your time, and this has been so great. I miss all you guys and can't wait until we are on stage jamming again for the people.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you loved this episode, please head over to our website, webanjo3.com, to subscribe, rate, and do leave us a review. It makes a huge difference. See you next time inside the Banjo House.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.